Now, one of the biggest questions that people struggle with, where do we get our concepts of right and wrong, good and evil? You know, there are basically two views. Some think moral authority comes from God or some transcendent source. Others think it's a purely human construct. And this isn't just armchair philosophizing. It gets down to some very nitty-gritty issues because we all, at some point or another, have to make moral choices. Where do we get our answers? How do we know what is right and what is wrong? That's something I'd like to spend a little time on the show looking at today. The fact is, I have very logical reasons for believing in things that logic and reason cannot teach me. It's kind of ironic, but the more complexity science finds in life, the more unlikely becomes the whole scenario and theory they use to explain the origins of life. The amazing thing that quantum physics shows is that nature, at its most fundamental level, strains human credulity and belief in ways that biblical faith never does. Hi, Cliff Goldstein here, and glad you've tuned in. You know, I want to start out with a poem called, interestingly enough, In Defense of Adultery. It was written by Julia Coppice. She begins, "We don't fall in love, it rises through us, the way certain music does, whether a symphony or ballad, and is sepia-colored, like tea that stains as it creeps up the tiny tube-like gaps inside a cube of sugar lying by a cup." She then goes on and gives more imagery, describing how this emotion comes to you without you expecting it, by chance or even by mishap. Then she writes something very, very interesting. Listen carefully, because this gets to the essence of her message, and to a degree, it gets through to the essence of mine today. Listen to what she writes. "We're victims, we say, merely vessels drinking the vanilla scent of this one's skin, the luster of another's blue eye skillfully darkened with bistra. And whatever damage might result, we're not to blame for it. Love is an autocrat and won't be disobeyed. Sometimes we almost manage to convince ourselves of that." Did you catch that last line? Sometimes we almost manage to convince ourselves of that. Almost manage to convince themselves that they're really not to blame? To blame for what? For adultery, for doing something that deep down they know is wrong, that deep down they know they shouldn't be doing. Why not? Why shouldn't they be doing it? Is it because their society says it's wrong? Is it because their culture tells them it's wrong? Do they have a religious upbringing that tells them it's wrong? Or is there something else, something transcendent, something unwritten even, something that goes beyond culture and what tradition, which says that you shouldn't commit adultery? You know, in our culture, perhaps one of the most reviled of all practices is pedophilia, especially men who prey on children, especially men who prey on young boys. I mean, these are the kind of people we put in jail, the kind of people who are stigmatized the rest of their life as sex offenders. I mean, you can find websites that will list who the convicted sex offenders are in your areas. It will show pictures to you of them and tell you where I live. I mean, when you get nailed for that, you get nailed for life. And really, what could be more morally egregious and horrible than people who do that, right? Well, I agree. It is morally reprehensible. And yet, you know, in ancient Greek culture, male-to-male pedophilia was a common, even accepted practices. In many cases, I know this is hard for us to grasp, in many cases, a young boy would be under the tutelage of an older man who would help educate him, instruct him, guide him, and at the same time, well, do things to that child that today would get him thrown in jail for 20 years. But you know, it was an accepted practice back then, common back then, in this rather highly sophisticated culture. The boy, after time with that mentor, would then join the military, and then after military service, would get married and start a family. Again, it was considered just fine. A practice that our culture finds criminally, even psychopathically evil. So again, I ask the question, where do our moral views come from? How are they established? What are the norms and how are they formed? You know, it was funny, as I was putting this together, this talk, I was reading a book on English grammar, on the rules for English, on the rules for language. And it was very interesting how certain grammar rules vary from style book to style book. One style book says you should put an apostrophe in certain word constructions. Another says you shouldn't do it. Another says you should put hyphens in certain places. Another says you shouldn't. And on with things like split infinitives, with ending sentences with prepositions, and so forth. One time it was a linguistic misdemeanor to do these things, and now it's all just fine. You know, it got me thinking, when we talk about the proper use of words, grammar, and so forth, you know, like, where do these rules come from? What makes the use of language right and wrong? Outside of clear-cut cases where the meanings are unclear, what makes a certain grammatical use right and another wrong? Grammar books? Well, you know, who died and left them the highest authority? Or perhaps you go to a well-established dictionary. But again, what makes the dictionary the final authority? I mean, these were written by human beings, right? Just like us. Though, depending on your view of language and the power and importance of language, one could argue that those who write dictionaries are like small gods. That's how much power they have in something in nature, in natural law. That's how much power they have, because they control words, and language is considered so powerful. You know, let me ask you a question. Is there something in some kind of natural law which says that in English, the word D-E-E-R, the word deer spelled D-E-E-R, as in the animal, should be spelled differently than the word deer, D-E-A-R, as in my dear friend George? I mean, if you were to write, I saw a D-E-A-R eating leaves in my garden, everyone who knows anything about the English language would agree that you have been using the word wrongly. But that's only because of common consent based on who knows what that has established the different spelling between these words. But is this the same kind of common consent that makes pedophilia so universally despised in our culture, but not in ancient Greece? Are moral values somewhat like the rules for language and grammar? I mean, if you think about it, what could be more arbitrary than rules for any language at all, especially when those rules change over time? You know, it's like this gets even thousands of times more complicated when you get into the thousands of languages out there. Why should one language use the word chien when another uses the word pero, another kelev, and another dog for the exact same species or for even individual examples of the species? Thus, I ask the questions, are moral values just as divergent from culture to culture as our languages? But if that is so, how can we explain this sense, for example, that in most cultures that certain things are just wrong, at least at certain times, such as, well, as adultery? Thus, we come back to the question of morality, the question that I asked in the beginning. Where does morality come from? Now, please, this isn't a new question. Oh, my goodness. Thousands of years ago, Plato, in one of his dialogues, The Republic, has a character who says basically that might makes right, period. Might makes right. I mean, if you don't have any transcendent moral absolutes, then why not doesn't might? Why not might make right? If morality comes only from human subjectivity, then that might be just as good of a reason for determining what is right than would any other thing. You know, a little before Socrates, in the 5th century BC, the famous historian Herodotus wrote in his histories about the practice of the Scythians. They had a thing about human skulls, especially those of their enemies. After they would kill an enemy, and that would even include a relative who turned on them, they would cut off the top part of the skull, but they'd keep the top part. Then they would clean out everything on the top of the skull but the bone itself, and they'd clean it up. Then they would finally gild it with gold and use them for cups. I mean, they drink out of them. It was considered a thing of honor to encourage to do that. Now, we, in our culture, we find that rather sick, rather macabre, don't we? But, like the writers of dictionaries, who died and made us boss? Who are we to say that something like that is morally wrong or repugnant? Again, this is, again, of course, if you don't believe in moral absolutes. You know, then you have the 17th century British philosopher Thomas Hobbes, who I believe I've mentioned him before on the show. You know, Hobbes, and this is very interesting, Hobbes argued that morality really is only what society declares it is. Good and evil, he said, he had no reference point beyond what people, in kind of a social contract, said good and evil were. You know, it's interestingly enough, too, that he said our knowledge of good and evil depends upon our language, upon having stable words that convey the ideas of good and evil. The only problem, however, is according to Hobbes, our language is not stable, is not firm, is not rooted in anything absolutes. And thus our concepts of good and evil aren't either. And that's really funny in a way, because I just got done talking about how arbitrary language is. And Hobbes took that idea, which is that, you know, that idea, tied it to language, which is arbitrary, and then tied that to morality, and thus argue that morality is arbitrary as well. I mean, if morality is founded on language, and language is so contingent and fluctuating, then what else could morality be but the same? Ugh. It's an embarrassment to me. You ever read the American Constitution? Look up the phrase in it, the peculiar institution. The peculiar institution? That's a pretty innocuous sounding phrase, isn't it? Yet that is what they used to define slavery. Slavery? Slavery itself, that sounds horrible. Peculiar institution doesn't. One minute, to be a patriot means to support the king. By the following Thursday, to be a patriot means an acquiescing and chopping off the king's head. Now, the point is, words, symbols, languages can all take on very different moral meanings. It's interesting, Slovenian philosopher Slavoj Žižek, in his book, The Parallax View, he told the story about a gigantic statue on a hill in Budapest of a woman waving an outstretched flag, a symbol of the liberation of the city by the Red Army in 1945. It was seen as this great emblem of socialist realism. The only problem was that the statue had originally been created in 1943 by the fascist Hungarian leader Admiral Horthy, who created in honor of his son, killed fighting the Red Army. Fighting the Red Army. That's how fluid and changing our symbols can be. But see, again, I ask the question, what about morality? Does it have a concrete foundation in nature, in God, in something transcendent? If not, then what are we left with? If all the world thinks something right, then is that something right no matter what it is? I mean, if all the world thinks it is, if all the world thinks it is, how could it be not? Unless morality comes from something that transcends humanity. Or who needs the consent of all the world? What about a democratic majority? We've been hearing a lot over the years about democracy, democracy, democracy. If this is the greatest thing ever, humans could ever devise. Let's say the majority of people in a democracy believe in something. Let's say they voted by a healthy margin, by a majority. Let's say they vote that all people with any kind of debilitating disease should simply be put to death. Is that wrong? Why should that be wrong? This is democracy, and the majority voted for it. And if morals don't come from anywhere else, then what's the gripe? What's the fuss? I remember, too, this is interesting. Amelia Earhart wrote a letter to this guy who wanted to marry her. And she made it very clear that she wasn't going to be tied down. Let me quote the letter. Let me quote her from this quote verbatim, because I find it very interesting. She says, this is Amelia Earhart writing to the man. Can you imagine you got your fiance and you're getting ready to write a letter to him and you say this, in our life together, I shall not hold you to any medieval code of faithfulness to me, nor shall I consider myself bound to you similarly. Sounds strange? Well, I mean, if faithfulness to marriage is really nothing but a medieval code, then why should somebody be in the 20th century be held to it? Friedrich Engels, he of Karl Marx fame, wrote that the idea of stealing something arose only when the concept of private property did. Let me quote you from him, because this is interesting. This is interesting because it's an interesting concept of how morals arose. Here's Friedrich Engels. You know, Friedrich helped fund Karl Marx. From the moment when private property and movable objects developed, in all society in which this private property existed, there must be this moral law in common. Thou shalt not steal. Does this thereby become an eternal moral law? By no means. In a society in which the motive for stealing has been done away with, in which, therefore, at the very most, only lunatics would ever steal, how the teacher of morals would be laughed at who tried to solemnly to proclaim the eternal truth, thou shalt not steal. Engels goes on to say this. We therefore reject every attempt to impose upon us any moral dogma whatsoever as an eternal, ultimate, and forever immutable moral law on the pretext that the moral world has its permanent principles which transcend history and the differences between nations. We maintain, on the contrary, that all formal moral theories are the product, in the last analysis of the economic stage at which society had reached at this particular epoch. Wow. Can we be more explicit than Herr Engels here? Doesn't like the idea of any kind of transcendent moral values. In fact, a so-called fellow traveler and a big influence on Marx was Mr. Ludwig Feuerbach, who railed against the idea of basing moral values in anything transcendent, especially divine. Listen to this quote. Whenever morality is based on theology, wrote this is Feuerbach, whenever the right is made dependent upon divine authority, the most immoral, unjust, infamous things can be justified and established. To place anything in God or to derive anything from God is nothing more than to withdraw it from the test of reason, to institute it as indubitable, unassailable, sacred, without rendering an account why. We need no Christian rule of political right. We need only one which is rational, just, humane. The right, the true, the good always has its ground of sacredness in itself, in its quality. Well, you know, that sounds rather noble on one level. On the other level, might I humbly suggest that there is a slight problem with Mr. Feuerbach's moral philosophy. Sure, we all want a morality that is rational, that is humane, that is just, that is true, that it's good, don't we? I mean, I would hope so. But I guess the question is, how are they defined? That's the problem. How are you going to determine what these things are? Okay? When you place morality anywhere, then in something beyond us, to quote him, that is unassailable, indubitable, sacred, who determines those things? Who determines what those things are? What is good? What is unassailable? Are they like grammar? Like spelling the animal D-E-E-R instead of D-E-A-R? You know, one of Hitler's propaganda posters showed a medical professional standing behind a disabled man. The poster reads, "This person suffering from heredity defects cost the community 60,000 Reichsmarks during his lifetime. Fellow German, this is your money too." Why not? Isn't there a certain rationality beyond that idea? Look what it costs to deal with someone who cannot be cured. Why get so bent out of shape over it being morally wrong? Who says it's wrong? Joseph Conrad, in his novel, The Secret Agent, looked at the question of morality of evil in a very fascinating way. I can still remember these lines from one character, a radical left winger, who says this. Listen to this quote. This is creepy. "I have always dreamed of a band of men absolute in their resolve to discard all scruples in the choice of means, strong enough to give themselves frankly the name of destroyers, and free from the taint of that resigned pessimism which rots the world. No pity for anything on earth, including themselves, and death enlisted for good and all in the service of humanity. That's what I would have liked to see." Close quote. But then he laments, quote, "I can never get as many as three such men together." Whew, that's a little creepy. In a similar vein, Fyodor Dostoevsky, in his novel The Possessed, wrote about these radicals and their vision for a new world, a new humanity, a new morality, with a radically different set of moral beliefs. There's a scene in the book when one of these radicals, in a relatively harmless symbol of their disdain for the old morality, goes up to an old nobleman and just bites him on the ear. Just goes up and bites him on the ear. It seems silly. But let me read. He says, "The old man suddenly felt that instead of telling him some interesting secret, Nikolai had seized the upper part of his ear between his teeth and was nipping it rather hard. He shuddered and breath failed him." Later on, the book talked about one of these radicals. It said that he, quote, "rejects morality itself altogether and holds with the last new principle of the general destruction for the sake of ultimate good." Now listen to this. "He demands already more than 100 million heads for the establishment of common sense in Europe." I'm at 100 million heads for the establishment of common sense in Europe. Are 100 million heads worth common sense in Europe? Who's to say otherwise? That is, if morals are not built on something transcending humanity itself. You see, again, this is the problem. This is the problem. People could come up with all sorts of really bizarre and things that kind of shock us, moral concepts, and yet, who are we to say? As I said earlier about the writer of dictionaries, who died and made the writer of dictionaries God, boss? What about us? Who are we to judge other moral systems as right or wrong? That is, again, if you don't believe in a transcendent morality, if you don't believe that morality comes from something greater than us. You know, a while back I was giving a talk on a college campus about the existence of God, and I've got one of my shows, I'm going to get into that a little more. And after going through the usual arguments, I talked about my own experience and my own search for truth. And when I said that, in times in the past, when I was an agnostic, Every night I would feel a conviction about God, that maybe God did exist. But each time that happened, you know what I did? I pushed the thought away. And why did I do that? Why did I push the thought away? If I'm really honest with myself, I didn't do it because of some kind of rational argument. This wasn't where the battle was. Instead, in other words, the reason wasn't in my head, it was in my heart. Because I'm going to focus on this a little more, I got a whole talk on this, but each time I would think that God existed or a God existed, I suddenly felt this conviction about morals, about how my life wasn't right, that what I was doing, that I was doing things that if there were this God, I'd probably get in trouble. And I think it's kind of funny that I felt convicted about doing things that were wrong in the eyes of a God that I wasn't even sure even existed. Now, what was interesting, too, is when I said, when I was speaking to these college students, was when I brought that up, I was trying all these logical arguments for the existence of God and all that's fine. But when I brought up to these students and I said this, told them what happened. I said, when I thought that there might have been a God, I suddenly pushed it away because I started to feel guilty about how I was living. It was funny. You should have seen the look on their faces. I mean, judging by the look on their faces, I think they could relate to what I was saying. But see, I asked the question, why? Why would these kids, why would they suddenly relate to, how could they relate to something that happened to me 30 years ago, 30 some years ago? Well, I guess probably because they were going through something similar themselves, which begs the question that I've been asking all along. Why do we have this innate sense of right and wrong? Something that sure seems to transcend culture. Something that transcends the way we've been raised. Something that could inspire even Julia Coppice to end her poem by justifying adultery with these words. Again, remember, she was committing adultery. Using all the arguments, all the, we didn't plan on it, it wasn't what we thought, we didn't want to do it, it just happened, it came upon us. And she goes on and on and on with all this justification for committing adultery. And then she ends it with these words, after all that justification. Sometimes we almost manage to convince ourselves of that. Sometimes we almost manage to convince ourselves of that. Almost. I wonder why just almost.